Yeah, it is much harder for a Brazilian winery to be selling their prices at a competitive price compared to any other producer. They are taxed much higher, which seems ludicrous, really.
Welcome to the Abwasi Wine Buzz podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clinton Lee. My next guest wears many hats, from being a wine reporter, travel and wine, and something we all love, food and wine. But not only that, she is a linguist as well. So I would like to invite, and I'm very pleased to have on our show today, Amanda Barnes. Amanda, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So as they would say, buenos dias, buongiorno, and bon dia, and bonjour, madame. You speak many languages. And how did that come about, Amanda?
Well, I think for me, language has always been access to travel. So as a young girl, I was interested in learning some kind of languages, European languages, in order to hop over to the continent and travel and be able to do that independently. So I think that was my real motivation. And Spanish, which is my main, the second language that I speak, really came through a love of Spanish culture and then later developed into this love of South American culture. And learning at school and then college and then at university, I studied some South American literature. And then moving here in 2009. Here's my cat.
What's the name of your cat?
Who is joining us?
Yes,
on the video. I apologize.
Her name. What's
her name? Is Pau Satoshi Nakamoto Gewürztraminer Trocken. She has a long name. Pau for Pau de Queijo, which is Portuguese for the Brazilian cheese bread, which is my absolute favorite. Snack. And then Satoshi Nakamoto, who's the famous creator of Bitcoin, because that's what Pau did when she was she was very young. And then Gewürztraminer Trocken, not because I'm a particular fan of Gewürztraminer, but I just love the way it sounds, and if I were to be drinking it would be Trocken.
okay, well, lovely name, and I have to confess that is the longest name of any cat that I've met. So lovely to meet you, Pau, for short. So Amanda, you know, tell us about you. Tell us how it all began, you know? Like if we're at a dinner party and we're asked to introduce ourselves, how would you do that?
I think I'd simply kind of describe myself as a wine writer, really, and a specialist in South American wine. Which is where I've been based since 2009. But my accent would probably very quickly give away that I'm not South American and was born in Hampshire in England and moved here at quite a young age at 23 and really kind of built my specialism in wine, but from a travel and food kind of background.
Excellent, excellent. And now, you know, we're focusing on wine, but you literally could have chosen any other topic. So what swayed you and propelled you into the world of wine and wine writing?
It's a very interesting question. And I think, you know, part of the reason I became a journalist was because you have this wonderful opportunity to write about so many different topics and meet so many different people on a daily basis that you can constantly be kind of inhabiting a different area or world or, you know, other people's stories and histories, which is something I very much love to do. And when I finished working in newspapers in England, or I was working in local newspapers in England, I started working a lot as trying to do some freelance food writing, gastronomy writing, and travel writing at the same time. And then decided to go freelance and move to South America and see if I could really dive deep into travel and food writing. But I didn't think you could be a serious food writer without having a great understanding of wine. And so that's why I decided to start my South American adventure in Argentina and focus on wine writing and learn about wine. And then I discovered that wine had everything that I loved, which was food, gastronomy, but also history, culture, geology, biology, chemistry. And I don't love biology or chemistry too much. I didn't as a student. But when it gets kind of involved in something as tangible as wine, it is quite fascinating, because all of those topics you can literally, you know, drink and enjoy in the glass and feel some of the differences of processes that have happened. And I just find that wine is such a thrilling medium for which to explore the world and different cultures and places.
I think in some life in the past, we must have been cut from the same cloth, Amanda, because the culture, the education of people and how they behave, how they react, what they love is very dear and near to my heart. And when I was going through your, I must admit, very colorful book, very, very
colorful. I love color.
yes. I noticed, you know, that there was areas in terms of the history and the culture, because unless you have that very strong sense, you don't and are not able to absorb the wine, the area, and the people. Now, you had mentioned you could have, you know, you've been a travel writer and, you know, you've written about food, and now it's all focusing on wine. In terms of preference, do you prefer more being a travel writer or food and wine, or specifically wine?
I think for me, travel writing has brought a great perspective to wine writing. And I certainly do not describe myself as a wine critic. And I think we have wine writers of very different genres, if you like. I'm a wine journalist as well. So I certainly write kind of news and interviews, and you know, a journalist is very much my profession that I've trained in. But I also think in terms of a wine writer, I'm more of a wine, you know, writer, like a travel writer that uses wine as the topic rather than travel. Whereas a wine critic or, you know, sommeliers who write have a very different language that they use as well and a very different focus. So for me, writing about wine doesn't mean that it's not travel writing in some respects. And many of the places that I visit in South America and beyond are so compelling in a travel sense and an adventure sense and a cultural aspect and a very personal human element too, that it really is, for me, it does cross over with travel writing. So I don't separate them that much. You know, I do think they cross over, and I still do some travel writing, and I certainly do write about food too. so I certainly do some food writing, but not as much as that kind of food critiquing and, you know, travel critiquing that I used to do. I much more prefer to kind of dive into topics that I find particularly interesting and worth writing about, rather than, you know, recommending restaurants and hotels, which is also valid, but perhaps a bit less challenging.
Yeah, I mean, clearly you have interlinked, you have this wonderful mosaic and tapestry of skills that I think wine has been the winner and all its elements thereof. So bravo, Amanda. And I think we're all much richer for that, and very much looking forward to further writings of yours in the years to come.
Now, thank you.
Yeah. Now, Amanda, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, you found that language was the most valuable currency when traveling. And obviously, you know, clearly Spanish is your main secondary language, as it were. But where did your interest in learning to speak Spanish stem from? Why not Italian more, or French, or the other sort of romantic languages? Why Spanish?
It's actually kind of an interesting story. I was always more interested in learning Spanish than the other European languages, because I very much enjoyed our family holidays with my parents to Spain. We would go almost every year to Spain, or occasionally France, but I felt more of a connection with Spanish culture and people, I guess. And at primary school, at secondary school, sorry, we were given the option of learning French or German. And my mum went in, my mother's actually from the US. And so she learned a little bit of Spanish. You know, she had her kind of Mexican kitchen Spanish when she was younger. And she went into school and really petitioned for them to teach Spanish. And they agreed to start teaching Spanish. I got assigned German, which didn't go down very well. So I had to learn French and Spanish in order to be able to take French. They were like, well, if you're gonna be allowed to do Spanish, you have to do French at the same time. So I had to learn French and Spanish at school. And then at college, chose the route of just Spanish. And then at university, became quite kind of passionate about learning Italian too. So I started learning Italian at university. But Spanish has very much kind of won out because I think it is, it's such an accessible language. It's spoken by so many different countries and communities around the world. And even though Italian, French, you know, Portuguese, they're all very beautiful and interesting. It's less, you have less kind of people or places to communicate with. So Spanish is just, you know, it is one of the world's most spoken languages, and it is such a passport to the world. But I love, you know, I love trying my portuñol still and speaking Portuguese, trying to when I can. And, you know, it's always good fun. Like, I'm not one of those people that shies away from making mistakes. So I always do a terrible conversation in whichever language, however far I can get, because, you know, I'm quite shameless in that I'm not embarrassed to make mistakes. So I always have a good go at languages anyway, wherever it is.
Well, that's the sign of a true champion, one that doesn't mind having their language skills dissected and sometimes laughed at. And it's happened to me so often. So often. And
I have many stories of when it's gone
share
wrong.
One with us. Share one with us, Amanda.
I was just remembering, well, yesterday my door in Mendoza, the lock jammed, and I had to get out a locksmith, and now it's absolutely fine. But when that first happened, it happens quite frequently in Mendoza. The first time it happened, I'd only just kind of moved here, and I got locked in my bedroom for about 6 hours, and it was on a feriado, so like a public holiday. It was so hard to get a locksmith in, and I eventually got this locksmith that came. He spent an hour, had to go out, get more equipment. And anyway, he eventually got me out. My Spanish was terrible. And, you know, I'm clearly not a local, clearly like a gringo, a foreigner. And the door opens and I go, mi salvaje, which I thought I was saying my savior, but I was actually saying my savage. And the poor man looked at me like, what is this crazy foreigner on about, calling me her savage man when I've just spent an hour rescuing
her? Well, I mean, these are real gems. I mean, these are real gems, you know, of stories. Yeah, that's wonderful, wonderful. So, you know, moving on to South America, you know, clearly the language, you know, was probably a major proponent. But apart from that, what influenced you to select South America as the focus of your writing skills, interest, and literally become the bugler for South American wine on the global stage?
Well, my fascination for South America was certainly beyond wine. It was very much, you know, wanting to know more about the culture, the people, like, you know, just falling in love from afar, and very much through reading. So I studied comparative literature at university at King's College, and within that studied a lot of Latin American literature, and specifically within that, magical realism. And I really just fell for the genre as a whole. Like, you know, I love the kind of idea of magical realism and, you know, reality being kind of bound with a, you know, marvelous kind of magical side too. And so really did kind of fall in love, you know, with South America, having never been, and also through music.
Having never been.
And also through music. And, you know, I had some language buddies in London at the time to practice my Spanish with, who were Peruvian, Argentinian, you know, big mix. And so there was that love for South America. And then when I decided that I wanted to, you know, try writing about food and travel and wine and try and go freelance, which is not an easy thing to do. And I knew it was going to be challenging. And I felt that going somewhere that wasn't quite so well explored was probably a smart decision because it might give me more opportunities to write for English language press. I felt that if I were to go to South Africa or Australia or New Zealand or even the US, that there are already plenty of native English speaking writers who probably service it very well. So that was my kind of thought, was a love and an interest, and the idea that potentially it would give me an opportunity to write about places that perhaps aren't as written about as some of the other kind of key wine travel destinations in the world. And then I just bought a ticket. It was a return ticket for a year, but I always intended to stay as long, you know, I thought, well, I'll give it a go for a year. If I can make it work, I'll stay longer. And much to my parents' disappointment, I stayed.
Well, I think they may be disappointed because they don't have you physically close to them, but I think they must be enormously proud of what you've achieved. And I can just visualize you there, Amanda, sort of, you know, pausing for a moment and, you know, like Robert Frost, you know, with I Came Across Two Roads. And you clearly have chosen the one that is less traveled. So that's marvelous. That's marvelous. Now, with your experiences in South America, Amanda, what commonalities and differences have you found within the South American winemaking process in terms of wine culture?
I think South America obviously is a very big continent, and quite diverse in terms of its climates, its regions, but it does share interesting kind of parts of history. So, you know, one of the reasons that I think it lends quite nicely to talk about South America together is because there are beautiful links between the countries in terms of where their wine histories began. It all started in the 1500s, really, when the first Vitis vinifera came from Europe. And so they all kind of started developing at a different time. And then there was a huge influence in the 1800s of the European immigrants coming in again and really kind of boosting the wine industries. And so they all share part of this kind of communal history related to immigration and the movement of people and also the immigration of Vitis vinifera vines. But they've all developed in their own pace and with their own culture and with their own reflective of their climate as well. So Chile and Argentina, where we certainly have the easiest climates for wine production, are the titans of South America. And so I find it very interesting to think of the differences, not only based on cultural and people, but also the challenges that they've faced due to their landscape and perhaps their political challenges as well. Peru and Bolivia, I think, are quite a lot slower to develop because they have more kind of political, and especially Bolivia has more geographical frontiers and boundaries as well. So it is interesting to kind of look at them through the lens of history. But one thing that is really kind of uniting South America in many ways, or at least Chile, Argentina, Bolivia and Peru, is this kind of return to artisanal production and looking back to some of their own kind of influences from hundreds of years ago, like using clay and tinajas, botijas, which are their kind of amphora, and looking back to using concrete. We certainly saw in the 90s a very big Bordeaux influence, the 2000s as well. That's kind of waning, but it's still very present. So it is interesting to see the you know, where they've shared these kind of waves of innovation and then everyone sort of returning in their own way. Grape varieties are obviously different in different countries. The climate makes and the soils make the wines very different. The families make the wines very different too. But they certainly do share a lot of kind of cultural elements through history.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, with Mendoza, you know, wonderful memories for me over there. And I recall with great passion, you know, the people, how they approached life itself. And, you know, going from small wineries to the big giants of like Bianchi in General Alvear, that was quite a wonderful visit. Now, many people in the world, when they think of Argentinian wine and Chilean wine, as you said, the Titans, they sometimes think of them as more of the entry-level wines. You know, do you think that's a fair observation of where those particular countries' wines would rank, or do you think this is changing?
I think the problem is that that this impression of kind of cheap and cheerful wines, which I understand that a lot of people do have, I think it's perhaps because they've over-delivered at that entry-level point. You know, you can get an excellent Chilean wine and Argentinian wine, more so yeah. Chile, I think, actually delivers at the very kind of entry-level range. You can get an excellent Chilean wine for $10-$15.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's delicious, and it's probably going to wipe the board in terms of quality, what you get from many other places at that price point. I think there's a couple of European countries, Spain notably, that will compete at that price point quite well. But I think they've kind of over-delivered, and so unfortunately given people the impression that they're just great for entry-level wines. But once you start moving up and tasting the great mid-range and high-end wines, yes, the very premium wines that they both have, these are wines that are certainly, you know, world-class, definitely deserve you know, position on the top shelf and deserve to be invested in and aged and kept in the same way that you would some of the great wines of the old world. I think it upsets me when people kind of dismiss them as being just kind of cheap and cheerful, because I think it just shows that they haven't investigated far enough. And actually, it's strange to me too, that if you're so confident in the cheap wines and you're quite happy to be drinking these as cheap wines, why wouldn't you have the confidence to spend twice as much and kind of step up and explore within a country that you already know does it excellently at such a cheap level? It's a funny kind of, you know, catch 22.
Yes, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And when I'm asked that question myself, I often, you know, use the example of Senna, you know, by Eduardo Chadwick. I said, well, you know, why don't you try them out? You know, they had quite a memorable opening in the world when they had these blind tastings in London, Hong Kong, against some of the world's finest wines, and they came out on top. So why don't you just spare a moment and explore that for a while?
Yeah.
Now, we've spoken about Chile and Argentina. I think many people know about that. But there is another powerhouse economically in South America, and that's Brazil. How do you see their wine industry? Because they're the only country that speaks Portuguese in South America for historical reasons.
Brazil is such a... I mean, in my book, I just describe them as a sleeping giant.
Yes.
Because I think we haven't yet seen Brazil really rise to its position in the wine world that I think it will take. Brazil is growing enormously in terms of a wine consumer. So that is really significant, especially in South America, because Brazil is the most important market for South American wine. Mm-hmm. It is the most important market within South America. Yeah. So for Chile and Argentina, their exports to Brazil are enormous. The wine culture in Brazil is growing rapidly, especially in the south, in the cities of Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, and really interest in wine is growing at a very rapid rate. I think we can see some really interesting similarities with the Chinese market as well, in that kind of very quick assimilation of knowledge and a very kind of savvy clientele that is, you know, quick at learning and quick to experiment and try new things. So they're really important in terms of a market, but as a producer, the bigger challenge that Brazil has versus the other, you know, Chile and Argentina, is that they do have a more challenging climate. You have a lot more humidity to face, but there's been incredible exploration in the last few years of different climates. while the heartland still is the south of Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul, which is the southernmost state. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's the coolest and has the coolest temperatures, which are better for wine growing. We're seeing some really interesting innovations happening at altitude elsewhere. So the Serra da Mantiqueira is one of my favorite wine regions of Brazil, which is just outside of Sao Paulo, Minas Gerais. Sorry.
Yeah, Minas Gerais.
And wines being produced there on the hillsides at altitude, either looking for those cooler temperatures in summer or flipping it and having your production in the winter. So harvesting in winter and pruning during the summer, which is a very interesting innovation, which I think will shake up Brazil very significantly. And we are already seeing rapid growth of that production method. So I think Brazil is probably not quite asleep, but awaking,
sort of
a giant
slumbering
that is awaking.
Out of it. It's awakening.
Slumbering giant.
Yeah, yeah.
It is, absolutely. Certainly. And I do think in the next 10 years, we're really going to see a big difference. But there are significant political challenges in Brazil. So, yeah, the taxes on Brazilian wine production are very high. And actually, for a Brazilian producer, you know, they're paying... But Chile has a great deal with Brazil where they don't pay much tax at all. And
well,
so it's much harder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is much harder for a Brazilian winery to be selling their prices at a competitive price compared to any other producer. They are taxed much higher, which seems ludicrous, really.
Okay. Now, that's very insightful. And I don't think many of the listeners would have... knowledge of that. So I know that your book is packed with all these sort of gems, and you cover the history and very insightful writing. Now, would you like to select one particular country in South America that almost virtually the majority of listeners would never even think of wine coming from there, that you would like to share with us?
I think Bolivia for me is a really interesting wine country. It's very much a kind of diamond in the rough, I uh-huh. think. And it is so isolated. It is the only country, I believe the only country in South America that doesn't have access
That's
to the
right.
sea, apart from Paraguay, but they have it through the river. But
and they have a navy as a result.
Exactly. Well, actually, so Bolivia puts their navy on Lake Titicaca.
Yeah.
But it is an isolated country that faces a lot of challenges. So getting any kind of winemaking equipment, it's a real logistical challenge. However, they have this climate at high altitude. Every wine region in Bolivia is at high altitude. They have this climate that's very interesting for grape growing. Gives you those, you know, lovely kind of like big diurnal shift and, uh-huh. and interesting temperature ranges and wines with a lot of expression and character. And then one thing I particularly love about Bolivia is the very old vines of their Criolla varieties, which are the varieties that first came in the 1500s and have kind of developed this whole native family of grape varieties born in Bolivia in this sense. And so you get very interesting, unique, authentic expressions of these old wines, especially the Moscatelli Alejandria, which some people produce as a lovely dry white wine. Mm-hmm. And it will often pick up the expression of all the kind of native vegetation around it. So in this case, often the Moye, the pink pepper trees, but also Chañar, lots of very interesting kind of trees and plant life around it. So Bolivia is one thing I'd look out for.
Okay.
But you're going to have to taste it really in Bolivia.
And it's not
moment.
Really.
There isn't many exports.
No, there's not many exports. I was about to say that. Now, where do you see the state of South American wines in, say, 5 to 10 years? What does the future hold for this continent on the global stage?
Well, I really hope that more people, more wine consumers will be adventurous mm-hmm. and start engaging further in South American wine. And part of the reason I wrote my book was because I really wanted to kind of bring that diversity to people and encourage people to explore, because there is a huge diversity of wine being produced throughout the different countries but throughout different regions as well. So, you know, I've lived in Mendoza for 13 years since 2009. And I can tell you that every day I go to the wine shop and there's something new to try, to buy, to taste. It is, you know, in South America, there's this continuous kind of movement and changes and innovation happening while still retaining identity and still retaining, you know, classic expressions as well. But I really hope that in 5 to 10 years, we'll see a shift, not necessarily in South America, because I think the trajectory here in terms of production is in a really good path. But I hope that the change that I would like to see are wine consumers, wine drinkers around the world becoming more engaged and really demanding from their wine shops and their importers to bring in some of those really unique and interesting wines from lesser known regions and lesser known varieties and start kind of exploring, because as you said quite rightly earlier, a lot of the wines are at a very accessible price point. So you could really dive into South American wine with a limited budget, and you can actually have a whale of a time exploring great wines, like delicious expressions, like totally different climates. And so I hope that that's the change that we'll see. I think it's very difficult to kind of project 10 years, because I think the last 5 years globally, we've seen such enormous changes. And I think we will still get those enormous kind of economic impact from the pandemic, from the shipping crisis, from the recession, from all the kind of economic woes that are firmly taking their grip in most countries around the world. And South America certainly is not escaping that by any means. In fact, I'd say it's potentially more impacted than many areas of the world. So I think it will be challenging, but I really hope, you know, the passion is there here. The passion is here. Producers are absolutely not going to be slowing down or stopping. And crisis in many ways breeds creativity. And I think one thing that I can tell you is that in the last couple of years of crisis and the pandemic, it's been really inspiring to see those winemakers looking introspectively and being more creative as a result of the kind of extra pressure that they've been under.
You know, talking about the economic woes that many on a global scale are experiencing, you know, certainly like in Europe, certainly in Italy, you'd have the consorcios, because you have so many smaller producers, and singularly, they don't have the economic clout to go out and market their wines on a national scale. Do you see that happening? Do you think it's the way to go for, I would think, a number of these South American wine producers?
Because definitely
certainly on an individual scale, I don't see them, and I may well be wrong, but I don't see them having that clout to get onto the stage and get someone interested to bring it out. It's a catch 22, because if we don't have access to their wines, how can we get to like them?
Absolutely. And it is, you know, it is a real disadvantage when you have so many small producers and medium producers and even large producers who do not have the budget, because it is so much more expensive and harder for them to reach marketplaces in a different language, often at a very great distance. And, you know, personally, that's why I also focused and put my energies in writing a book by myself and self-publishing, because I wanted to give a platform and an opportunity for producers who can't afford to get out there, to get out there through words, at least. And there are so many kind of sommeliers who've made that their mission to really kind of seek out these producers and try and get them on their menus. There's lots of smaller associations that have been founded, often with some governmental funding. So in Chile, there's been a really interesting focus from Corfu and ProChile, which are two government institutions that have created small pools of funds, which producers can use to get together and form associations. So we have Sur Natural, which is focused on small natural wine producers in the south of Chile. There's Sur Chileno, which is focused on producers making wines also in the southern areas of Chile, which are often the ones that don't have access to the same you know, to the same platform as some of the bigger wine regions. And then you've got lots of associations of producers forming their, you know, their area associations. In Argentina, for example, we have Los Chacayes, which is an IG, geographical indication. Yeah. They've formed an association. You have the same for Paraje Altamira. So we're definitely seeing producers get together, trying to promote each other and put it on, you know, create a platform for greater communication. We're certainly seeing a lot of communicators and sommeliers really trying to do that. And so I really hope that we will see a greater platform in so many ways created for producers, but it is definitely a challenge.
Well, I mean, it's very sensible.
That they face,
yeah,
for sure.
I mean, it's very sensible. Now, and I certainly hope that in the years ahead, we will have that opportunity to taste these wonderful wines coming out from the South American continent. Now, should I be blessed and have the opportunity, Amanda, to have a wine tasting with you? And if you were to select a truly South American flight lineup, say four wines, what would you select and why? And now that you're also a food writer, what food? What would you pair with it?
It would be my pleasure to have a wine tasting with you, Dr. Lee, hopefully Excellent. One day soon. But I would be arguing for more than four wines. four is
I like you even
question.
More, Amanda. Yes. Okay.
I want at least space for 12. But if I'm going to pick four, so four wines which really represent South America. I mean, the Bordeaux varieties are big here. Cabernet Sauvignon is probably the most planted. But rather than pick Cabernet Sauvignon, I'd probably start with a Malbec, because I do think that, you know, Malbec gives us an opportunity to travel not only the wine regions of Argentina, and very beautifully so, but also, you know, Malbec first made its way to Chile before Argentina in the 1850s. We get some lovely Malbec in Brazil, in Bolivia. It's grown everywhere, actually, but Argentina is very much the champion. So I'd definitely start with a nice Malbec, not necessarily start, but it would be in the flight. And I'd be looking for showing a very specific, singular regional expression, perhaps like El Cepillo, which for me in the Yucca Valley is one of the coolest expressions of Malbec. And so it gives you a totally different, lovely kind of more herbal, really fresh, and floral expression, or one of those kind of cooler climates in the Yucca Valley, like Paraje Altamira is very silky. We could have Guaitayeri, where you have a you know, some more kind of spine to it, and bones. So definitely a Malbec to warm up. I'd 100% have a Pais in the tasting. So Pais being the first variety that was brought to South America, known as Listan Prieto in Spain, and was the most widely planted for the first couple of hundred of years of history of South American wine. And we still get some great Pais expressions in Argentina, where it's known as Criolla Chica, in Bolivia and Peru as well. But I'd pick one from Chile, and I'd probably pick one, which is where it's the most grown. And I'd probably pick one from Etata or Maule, which are two kind of great heartlands for Pais. Mm-hmm. And if you were to give me more space, I'd probably have each to show you the comparison.
I can give you latitude on that.
Talking of those Criolla varieties, I'd also definitely pick a Muscatel de Alejandría, but I'd go with an orange wine, because I think Muscatel de Alejandría was one of those first varieties that was brought by the Spanish, and has been, if Pais is the father, then Muscatel de Alejandría is the mother of the Criolla varieties, given birth to great varieties like Torrontés. But I think it's very exciting to see producers going back and making orange wines from Muscatel and using traditional techniques like, you know, skin ferment in tinajas or botijas, which we find, you know, some lovely Muscatels from Chile, from Peru, and from Bolivia, and also some in Argentina. So I'd probably pick pick one of those. And then for a fourth wine, to pick something maybe from Uruguay. And we could pick Tanat, but I think if we've already gone for quite classics, let's go for Albarino, because I think Albarino really shows the kind of innovative side of South America. We're seeing this explosion of great white wines in South America at the moment, and with really diverse varieties. And I think one of the great stars that's emerging is Uruguayan Albarino. And it just suits the climate so wonderfully. Uruguay has a much more humid Atlantic climate, quite different to the cool Pacific climate of Chile. And I think Uruguayan Albarino is just such a delightful wine and really embraces that kind of pioneering and innovative spirit that is still very much part of South American wine and kind of is one of those key players in the explosion of delicious white wines.
Well, you know, Amanda, I'm riveted. Would you mind, if you could excuse me, I just want to book my ticket to Mendoza right now.
I forgot my food pairing.
Yeah, no
my
problem.
My food pairing. Very okay, quick. So yeah. Malbec has to be steak, delicious steak.
Yep.
Always.
Asado, yeah.
Yeah, asado. País, I'd go with a really nice traditional morcilla, kind of black sausage or local sausage from southern Chile. Mm-hmm. Which they add some nice spices, really lovely. Albarino would have to go with some of the lovely seafood from the coast. I'd probably just sneak in some of the Chilean coastal seafood, because Chile really has, and Peru has some of the best kind of mariscos and shellfish. And then for our orange Moscatel, let's have like some llama. I'm very meat focused here, but I love some of the kind of Andean, llama and I'm blanking on the name of the other one that I really enjoy eating, but like the lovely, it's a very kind of lean meat and
now I have to confess, really quite nice. I've never had llama before. Okay. All right. I'll have to put onto my list. Superb. Superb. I think I'll have to book my ticket sooner than later. No, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, Amanda, you're living in South America. There must be challenges. I mean, Mendoza, having been there and spent some time traveling around, I just love the airport. You come out and you're greeted with this vineyard straight away, and you know you're in wine country. Is there any particular country in South America that you see will be the next darling of the wine world? And will we have this historic position and witness its stellar rise? Is there any one that if you were to think about?
Well, I think Argentina and Chile already are darlings of the wine world. And they have a very well-established and excellent wine tourism.
Apart from them, yeah.
Yeah. So I do think we'll see Uruguay rise in terms of people's awareness of it as an interesting wine country and certainly great country to visit and spend time in. I don't think we'll witness much growth because Uruguay is very small and there isn't enough kind of space to, there's plenty of space, but it's got an important kind of cattle industry. So I can't say we'll see it exponentially growth in terms of numbers, but I do think in terms of reputation, I think Uruguay is poised for international discovery on a greater level. You know, it has really good quality production, it has very knowledgeable winemakers, has really great identity in the sense that the wine industry is made up of so many small and diverse families that all have their own unique story and history and heritage to show through their wines, and they do that. No wine tastes the same as a neighbor's wine in Uruguay. It does not happen. They all taste very distinctive and different, and so I think that will be really interesting as people begin to look for very personal wines. And I think that's something we are seeing more in the wine industry at large. I think Uruguay is just ripe for discovery. And the country is just fabulous to visit. Very peaceful. Montevideo, if you've ever been, I think is the most calm, quiet capital city in the world. And it is just a lovely, charming, calming place to be, with great wines, great food, and just a really nice, open and intellectual kind of community and wonderful lifestyle. And I think, you know, politically, quality wise, economically, it is in the right position to be a darling of the wine world.
Okay. So as they would say, one word, everything is tranquilo.
Tranquilo, yeah. Yeah.
Now, Amanda, I've enjoyed many hours of your book. And thank you for showing us. So just show us the cover of the book again, Amanda. So for our listeners, the South American Wine Guide, that has been passionately with love and heart, and I'm sure many hours of sacrifice, Amanda has put her soul into this book. I have found it immensely rewarding, learning so many different aspects, and I've done my fair share of traveling. So how can now listeners buy the book? Tell us about that.
So Academie de Vin is distributing the book worldwide. So you can go to Academie de Vin's website and you'll find it there. And if you want to get the ebook, then pop along to my website, the South America Wine Guide, and you'll find the ebook there. It's a big book. So it's I didn't want to shy away from a big kind of print edition. So it is heavy. So if you want it for traveling, I recommend the ebook. But if you want to look through the beautiful pictures that all my photographers contributed, then I really urge you to get print. But it depends on what you want to use it for.
Well, I would recommend both copies, one for the home and you're having that lovely coffee or glass of wine from South America. And certainly when you're traveling, I have found the ebook copies to be enormously valuable in terms of saving space, and not to mention the weight on your arms. Now, Amanda, just to end off, describe your ideal evening for us.
Oh, I like, there has to be wine. I try not to drink wine during the day. So I very much look forward to 7 o'clock and having a nice glass of wine in the evening. And there has to be food, because I love food and wine, and I actually really love cooking. So my ideal evening is probably myself cooking, either with friends here in South America. I live in Mendoza, so I love to cook here, but then I also really enjoy exploring and being somewhere else and trying the local wine, going to the fish market or the local market. Awesome. Spending the day kind of seeing what looks good and tasty, and then kind of cooking it up, and ideally enjoying with friends. A nice simple evening with good food, good wine, and good conversation.
Well, on such a spectacular note of simplicity, but with enormous joie de vivre, I would like to say thank you very much, Amanda, for being on the Abwazi Wine Buzz show. It's been a real pleasure, and we wish you every success with your book. And I look forward to that wine tasting we're going to have. Thank you very much, Amanda.
Thank you. Me too.
You've been listening to Wine Buzz Podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please leave a review or share it with a friend. Abwazi is an online wine and spirit institution dedicated to promoting culture and diversity through the world of education. If you're looking to get started, we have a free online course that we are giving out to all our listeners. For more information, head to abwazi.com. That's APWASI.com.